Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Mixed Mental Arts with the best prepared guest I have ever had on this show. This is incredibly exciting. Reed Nice Wonder is here as ambassador for Magna Bosco. He's here on behalf of the street epistemology community. Reed,
yeah, that's
this
right.
is a lot of pressure.
Tons of pressure. I don't know how I feel about this, but let's do it. And this is my first podcast debut. I am terrified.
Well, the important thing is that you stepped into the ring, you stepped into the intellectual Thunderdome, and you're here. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing to say is just sort of set up, let's take your cultural confession. And let's hear about where'd you grow up, what's your deal, what cultural influences affected you, and then why do you think you particularly resonated with mixed mental arts?
Totally. Who am I? Basically nobody compared to the rest of the guests on this podcast. I have no quantum physics or any PhDs or anything like that.
Don't be modest.
I have a BA in cinema studies from UCF in Orlando. I grew up in Southwest Virginia on the Tennessee border and very close to Appalachia. And I found mixed mental arts, I think, through the Joe Rogan podcast. And I just really was captivated by it. And I started listening to all of the back catalog and all of your old blog posts. I read all of them and I had a...
Well, I feel sorry for you there. There's a lot of crazy to handle there.
Oh, man, yeah.
But when you say you're captivated, I think you mean you're captivated by Brian Callen, just to be clear.
Totally, yeah. Yeah. It was all Brian Callen.
It was really Brian. Emperor Callen was just really the magnetism, the how does he not age? It's a lot to ask.
Yeah.
But culturally, what do you think is your cultural ancestry? What would you say you picked up from your folks?
Well, I grew up in the South. I went to high school in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But my mom is from the mountains of West Virginia. And huge honor culture there, I would say. So she was very polite and very nice. And I think I picked up a lot from that. And I never felt like I would be confrontational in any way with anyone. And I think that's a lot of my cultural history there for sure.
But do you feel there was a tension between what you were picking up at home and what it was in the surrounding community?
When I moved to Orlando to go to college, I think so. There was some culture starting to conflict there for sure. I think I really didn't know any gay people when I went to college, and then that was a huge culture shock. I went to a communications department, the film department, and there's just a huge variety of people there.
It's pretty gay, is what you're saying.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and the rainbow is alive and well in the film departments of universities around the country.
Totally.
Yeah.
So that was a huge culture shock, and just the different ideas I picked up, and it was a totally huge difference for sure.
Well, I think that's also interesting. What did movies and what did films mean to you growing up in Chattanooga?
Ever since I can remember, I've always had a video camera in my hand. I was playing around, just shooting videos, doing these little movies with my friends, with Legos and doing other fun things with videos and movies. And when I went to high school, there's a film course there, or just a couple film classes, and I got really interested in the history of movies. And it's just always something I've been interested in. It's something I've always had a passion for. So after high school, I went to film school and had a great time there. But I mostly liked film school because there's just so many people that had the same passion for making movies. I could make movies in my spare time. I could hardly even bothered with my classes. I just kind of We made like a web series with my friends. Like that was all we did, was just make movies all the time.
So yeah, so I think that's what's interesting is with all of this stuff, it's like food, it's everything else. It's when you have the same passion as a group of people, you're able to connect with them regardless of what your background is, what your sexual orientation is. Like that passion for movies really transcended any cultural differences and what brought you together and then what allowed you to work through them and to become able to understand and connect on something, that primal feeling about movies.
Totally, yeah.
That's great. And so now, you know, confession is over. Congratulations, you survived it.
Thanks.
And it's appropriate that, you know, I mean, we're sort of blending and mixing up here, confession, and then we're going to talk about Magna Bosco and street epistemology. So who is Magna Bosco?
Anthony Magna Bosco is just some guy on YouTube using this conversational method called street epistemology to talk with people in public about their deeply held beliefs in a friendly, non-confrontational manner. And I'm a huge fan.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. And he clearly, I mean, you know, somebody, was it you that suggested that we connect originally?
Like, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I tweeted you about him.
Yeah. This is, you know, I mean, every fan's dream, right? So what happens is he retweets me and says, you should connect with Anthony Magna Bosco. And I'm like, great. That's great. Let's set it up. Uh-huh. And then Anthony turns it around and says, actually, you should talk to Reed. He knows about as much about this as anybody else. And so then he put you in the firing ring to represent him. And so here you are.
Yeah, thank you, Anthony, for doing that. So here I am.
It's a huge honor, but also a lot of pressure. But
yeah,
I think there's no better way for you to have to practice, you know, what you've learned than having mm-hmm. to try and teach it to me and try and teach it to the listeners. Mm-hmm. So you sent me some resources to prepare me. I'm not as well prepared as you. I mean, you have this iPad out. There's a list of notes that's like 1,000 pages long. But what I thought was interesting is that Anthony begins some of his talks by talking about how he used to be an angry atheist.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean to you? Were you an angry atheist? And why did Anthony transition out of that? And, you know, why do you think that's a dead end?
Yeah, I think we both used to be angry atheists. For myself, I grew up, you know, Christian, coming from the South. And then through high school, I didn't go to church anymore. I was at a boarding school, and I just kind of got apathetic about it all through college. And in college, I had an atheist roommate, and that was the time of, you know, the Four Horsemen, all their books came out, and he was super passionate about it, but never, like, challenged me or gotten any arguments with me. It was just, he was that guy. And I saw that he wasn't, you know, an evil or bad person. So I got kind of interested in that. And after college, I kind of lost my faith completely by then. I got really interested in science and, as they say, counter-apologetics.
Ooh, counter-apologetics. What's that?
It's like all like the atheist defenses against religion, you could say.
Oh, okay.
All the arguments and stuff like that. But then a few years ago, a book came out called A Manual for Creating Atheists. And an angry atheist like myself, you know, who doesn't like religion, that's the type of book you want to read. And I think it converted me from this angry fundamentalist atheist into just a compassionate human who sees, you know, religion as just another thing that people use to, you know, get by in the world. And but the book tries to show how someone could have a conversation with someone about these deeply held beliefs like religion in a way that lets you figure out what's the most reliable way of coming to these types of beliefs. that's what it's mainly about. It's
well,
about,
and that's the epistemology part, right?
Yeah.
So epistemology, just, you know, again, like, I love academics. I just love them. Mm-hmm. Epistemology is an amazingly fancy word for just how do you know what you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
But I think what's interesting is that, you know, that title of that book, right? Magna Bosco breaks that down a little bit in his talks, and it's not necessarily actually really about making atheists per se. It's really just about getting people to be more reflective about their beliefs so that we can decide, are these beliefs really serving me? Are they setting me up for success? What are the consequences for my actions, right?
Yeah, you could say it's like a manual for creating critical thinkers in general.
But listen, people got to sell books.
Yeah.
And that's a, you know, what's a catchier title? What's more likely to get people, a certain community, very excited? So this street epistemology thing, and Magna Bosco shows some of his, you know, angry atheist phases and how those talks didn't go well.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they went extremely poorly. Yeah. And he has this video where he shows him going up to this guy, I think it's in Austin, is it? Somewhere in Texas, I think.
I think it's San Antonio, at the Alamo, yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't go well, and essentially the whole conversation breaks down. And essentially he had burned that bridge, which is something I know about. But that, I feel slightly different about burning bridges. I don't necessarily know that that's problematic, because bridges can be rebuilt. And it makes for a better story when you've burned the bridge and then rebuilt the bridge. So, you know, and that's a part of what I think we should get into in terms of how you use social drama to engender reflection around ideas. But he evolves from this, and he evolves into not being such an angry atheist and towards this street epistemology approach.
Yep.
And so this street epistemology approach, it's essentially, I mean, what's interesting is the ways in which it ends up feeling kind of like missionary work in some way, in the sense that you really are fishers of men and you're going out there and you're interacting with people just, you know, it's one-to-one, as you said. You're not as esteemed as some of the guests that we've had on this, but you just go out and you talk to people, and it's a chance to engage them on why do you believe what you believe, and to sort of unpack these things.
Yeah, it's a non-confrontational way of examining a belief and the reliability of the methods one uses to be confident that the belief is true.
Reed is looking at his notes right now.
I want to get that right. I just want to make it clear. And my goal when I go out in public is to just provide an opportunity for someone to just think a little bit more deeply about what they believe.
And you have some videos of you going out and doing this. And my favorite is your one with Bambi.
Oh, Bambi.
I love Bambi. What's Bambi's deal? Do you actually know Bambi, or was Bambi just a random person?
She was just a random person out there in February in like Los Angeles weather. That's still pretty chilly. It was like 50 degrees, but she's out there in just a bikini.
Wow.
I think they were like doing a video shoot nearby for like her, whatever she was doing. And she sat down. And we chatted about the law of attraction, I think. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, so, and I mean, I think what's interesting, too, is that there's, obviously, we talk about religion. But part of the interesting thing is that humans have so many beliefs that are problematic that aren't necessarily religion. Like, is the law of attraction religious? It's mystical. It's woo-woo. But, for example, I talked with Spiros about being Greek and the Greek tendency to not pay taxes. And that's a whole belief system, a whole cultural apparatus that it is like a religion to not pay taxes in Greece. But it's hugely, hugely problematic. There's obviously, there's medical versions, and you always already, I'm like, oh, do I say that one? Do I say that one? Because you know that any one that you say, you're just going to get a whole bunch of blowback.
Be careful where you're going to be going with this. Yeah.
So, but humans believe lots and lots of problematic things. And so I think that's it makes sense in terms of marketing this, that you say, oh, how to create atheists. But I think what's much more interesting for especially the mixed mental arts community, which is pretty diverse in terms of where we come from and where we're more mostly focused on that sort of compassionate approach, is that street epistemology can be used for anything.
Yeah.
It can be used politically. It can be used in terms of medical beliefs. It can be used in terms of scientific beliefs. It can be used in terms of what you believe about your sports team, or, you know, mm-hmm. you can tell that somebody is just super into a particular athlete or a particular team. Like, think about Deflategate. Can street epistemology be used around Deflategate?
Probably.
De-radicalize Pats fans and get them to see whatever it may be, or if you're on the other side of things, to try and convince that side. Because mm-hmm. people form beliefs and they constantly shape and reshape those beliefs to justify their side.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the sorts of techniques that street epistemology is using on somebody like Bambi or Katie O'Brien on the issue of Deflategate? Because I'm going to tell you right now that she is not rational about that.
Uh-huh.
When Tom Brady is in the equation, reason goes out the window.
Yeah. SE is basically the Socratic method. So if you know about the Socratic method, you kind of know how it works. And I've got the definition of the Socratic method from Wikipedia here.
Jesus, read it off that iPad.
All right. It's a form of cooperative argumentative dialogue between individuals based on asking and answering questions to stimulate critical thinking and to draw out ideas and underlying presumptions. So that's the Socratic method. It has five different stages. The first is wonder. The second is the hypothesis. The third is the aluncus, which is just a fancy term for the Q&A. And the fourth is either accepting or denying that hypothesis. And the fifth is acting accordingly. So one way to characterize SE is simply the Socratic method applied to wonder questions of the form, like, what ways of knowing are sufficiently reliable to justify holding this belief?
Let's put a pause there, because I have a really big question.
Sure.
Is your name your real name?
It is.
Your real name is Reed Nice Wonder.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That's amazing. Where does Nice Wonder come from?
I think it's like some type of Scandinavian name that got changed.
There's some real Ellis Island happened there.
Totally. Yeah.
But it's in terms of a name for somebody who is doing street epistemology, you literally couldn't have picked a better name.
Yeah, I think there's like studies about how someone's name can like guide them into whatever they want to do.
There are indeed. People named Larry and Laura are more likely to be lawyers, and people named Dennis and Denise, mm-hmm. I think, are supposed to be more likely to be Dennis.
Yeah, I had a dermatologist called Dr. Rash.
Oh, wow.
So these things happen, but I didn't know anything about the Socratic method and like how crucial like wondering is good for this when I first knew about this, but somehow it's like a nice coincidence.
Well, and that's, I think, you know, this sort of brings back your mom, right? Because your mom seems very nice, very polite, and mm-hmm. then you're bringing wonder to the party. So Nice Wonder is really, it doesn't get much better. But when, mm-hmm. when you, because you originally, our first interaction was you emailed about volunteering for the Culture Matters videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And both Katie and I were like, what is that name? How do we get that name?
It never fails to, you know, put a smile on somebody.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But so crucially, I mean, much of what Katie and I do in tutoring is the Socratic method.
Yeah.
Cool. This was figured out 2,000 years ago. And it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it works crucially because, I mean, let's just think through in terms of these steps. So first step, I have a belief. I've never really examined it. And then you hit me with step one. What's step one again?
Wonder.
Oh, wait a minute. Suddenly, and now rather than attacking the belief, what you've done is you've created curiosity or wonder around the belief. Like, isn't that strange or odd? And then what that does is it creates an emotional state between the two people of examining this thing and having no predetermined conclusions mm-hmm. about what this thing is, so that we can now unpack it together.
Yeah, it turns the situation from being like adversarial into cooperative.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So then step two, what happens to me emotionally in step two?
You choose a hypothesis.
Okay, so let's say Katie O'Brien. I'm going to play the role of Katie O'Brien in here, and I'm going to be like, fucking Tom Brady didn't do anything wrong. Tom Brady is amazing. Tom Brady, Tom Brady. And so you are like, this is terrible, by the way, because I don't know anything about sports. But so we create wonder around this Deflategate thing. Like, how do we know? What should the right pressure on balls be? Like, what is the deal? So mm-hmm. now we're curious about this thing mm-hmm. and we're unpacking it. And, you know, how did they even collect that data on that balls? Like, mm-hmm. are we even sure? And this is exciting for Katie/me, because there's the possibility that when we really sift into this data, that we're going to find out that Tom Brady was A-okay on this.
Mm-hmm.
But now we create a hypothesis. And so what sort of hypothesis might we create there?
Yeah, so the hypothesis has to, for SE, the hypothesis needs to be around the reasons why we would hold this belief to be true.
Right.
So we would have to come up with a hypothesis, a potential reason why this happened. Or
so this is like steel manning, where you're like, let's run with your idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we're going to run with the idea that there is some vast conspiracy against Tom Brady because everybody's jealous because he's so handsome.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, things have been done to the pressure measuring system or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So you're like, great, what would it take to actually do that? Like, how would this grand conspiracy have to play out?
Yeah, so if someone had the wonder, you know, of, you know, Tom Brady is innocent.
Yeah.
So I would first ask, how confident are you that he is completely innocent? Say on a scale from 0 to 100, and let's just say they're like 100% confident.
I am 100% confident as Katie O'Brien that Tom Brady is 100% innocent.
All right, yeah. So what gets you to that 100% confidence? Like, why do you believe that?
Uh-oh, uncomfortable feelings. How are you going to handle this, Reed? Nice wonder. I'm starting to get a little uncomfortable, and maybe there's some cognitive dissonance and some defensiveness that's coming out.
Yeah, and I would be sure to listen and in a friendly manner and repeat back what I'm hearing her say, so she knows that I'm like on her side. We're both trying to figure this out together, and stuff like that.
So, okay, so then we're like, okay, well, let's really look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, maybe some humor is used where mm-hmm. we're like, don't worry, we all know that Tom Brady is 100% innocent, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, but we just have to build a better case so we can prove it to those other people that they are wrong about Tom Brady.
Yeah.
So then we proceed to step three. So we've got a hypothesis that we're running with about Tom.
Yeah, so we have the hypothesis, some reason. So then we kind of think about something that, if true, would mean that the hypothesis wasn't actually true.
Uncomfortable feelings as Katie O'Brien.
Yeah.
So we have to start to consider that, but maybe we sort of like start with something soft and gentle. We're mm-hmm. not saying that there is any bad, you know, malfeasance or bad play or not acting in good faith on the part of Tom Brady or Bill Belichick or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We just say that maybe something less threatening, like an accident was made. It was like, you know, there was some oversight in the pressurizing of the ball.
Yeah, like, could it be possible that this was an accident?
Yeah, and that's not threatening to me. Mm-hmm. And so now maybe that I'm willing to entertain, because a lot of what we're trying to deal with here is, you know, who's the good moral actor? Who's the good guy here? And I'm convinced that Tom Brady is the good guy as Katie O'Brien. So the idea that you can't move from me thinking that Tom Brady is the good guy to moving to thinking that Tom Brady is the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
But you can float this middle alternative that is not threatening, where it's not Tom Brady's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So something happened that was not... There was a mistake that was made, and it's no fault, no harm. So you're now nudging me.
Yeah, we start on the periphery to kind of open the door to thinking about this a little more deeply and then start working our way down.
Yep. Okay, so now step four.
Step four, like, say, so the hypothesis is, okay, maybe it's an accident. If she accepts that as a possible refutation of her hypothesis, then we reject that hypothesis. Or, she has to come up with something else that might be the reason why this happened.
So if I'm like, but it wasn't an accident, mm-hmm. then we have to figure out, okay, well, what else could it have been?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, well, I suppose that, somebody could have wanted to help out Tom, because Tom is so amazing on the Patriots.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe somebody like in the Patriots organization who like just loved Tom as much as I love Tom wanted to help him out. And so they changed around with the pressure of the balls, but it still wasn't Tom's fault per se.
Mm-hmm.
It was just some like well-meaning intern or something like that.
Yeah. And if it's like someone's just personal testimony about this, we could start asking questions about, you know, is that a reliable way of coming to know that this happened that way? Or is there like better evidence for this? Like what would you have to learn or find out to change your confidence about this?
What smoking gun would I need?
Yeah.
It's some sort of tape of Tom Brady just being like, I don't care. I'll do anything to win. Steroids and inflated balls. This is what my whole career has been built on. It's just lies.
Yeah.
So something like that. And so then do we get to step five?
Step five is acting accordingly. And usually the conversations end with someone in this aporia type of mindset.
Aporia?
That's what they call it. It's basically just, you know, in deep thought.
They're reflective.
Reflective.
Yeah.
So.
Like, because Aporia, by the way, is the name of the new skincare line that I'm starting.
No way.
Yeah, the fighter and the kid has shoes. I think that Mixed Mental Arts needs a skincare line. Aporia.
So yeah, most of the time, people's deeply held beliefs are not going to change in a 5-minute conversation. What we're doing with studio epistemology is just putting pebbles in people's shoes. Stuff to let people think about their beliefs a little bit more deeply. So once they're in that, you know, nice reflective state of mind, we kind of end the conversation there and let them go on their way and reflect about it privately.
Right. And the real goal is ultimately to create a humanity that is more reflective.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is it's triggering slow thinking so that people, you know, are reflecting on their own beliefs to form better beliefs.
Yeah.
And that's a virtuous cycle. At a certain point, you get involved in that and you get engaged in that and you start to have fun with it. And then you're doing it all the time. And you end up like one of the Laputans staring at the ceiling because you're reflecting mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah. Trying to get people into the experimental mindset rather than the litigious one.
Mindset. Exactly. Yeah. And to that end, I mean, in terms of experimenting, so how long have you been doing this street epistemology business?
In person, out on the street in public, since probably September of last year.
And so in that time, in those 6 months or so, mm-hmm. how has your approach evolved?
It's been a process. Like, as you can probably tell, I'm not the most extroverted person. So just going out there and actually chatting with people in public is something I wasn't comfortable with at all at first, but now I'm very, very comfortable with it. It's a fine thing to do for me. And just learning the process and like what questions work best and what situations. And it's been a lot of fun. Like I've had tons of great conversations with people and they seem to enjoy thinking about these types of things. Like
yeah.
By the end of it, they're like, well, like, wow, like I really appreciate this conversation. And this was a lot of fun. Like I want to keep going, but my friend like is, you know, one, like I've had a conversation with someone who's like, I have a friend just standing by, but trying to pull him away, but he wants to keep talking, but they're really interested. Yeah.
And how much have you tried doing this on the, you know, does it have to be on the street or have you tried doing this online?
Yeah. That's another problem with the term street epistemology.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be out in public or in face to face at all. You could do it with friends or family members online on social media. You could do it anywhere.
Because I think that's what's interesting in sort of my own recent experiments. The thing that I've become fascinated by is the idea of using the internet to de-radicalize fundamentalists.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty ideal because you're not face-to-face with the person. And in terms of, you know, it's one thing to challenge, you know, Western fundamentalists, whether it's the ANCAPers or the atheist fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. But it's obviously a very different ask to do that with Muslim fundamentalists,
yeah.
where you are risking life and limb.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, in terms of that street epistemology, people do that. Like there are people in the Muslim world who
oh, really?
Do that. Yeah, it's wow. pretty amazing. So one of my favorite stories is a family friend in Libya. There was these young guys who at some point were going and planning to destroy a Sufi mosque.
Hmm.
And I don't remember, I told this story, I think previously on the podcast, and then my mother came in and like, you know, cleared up my understanding of the different Muslim sects. So I'm going to screw this up. Let's just put that out there. But there's some deal where the Sufis They, I think, bury their dead within the mosque or something like that. And to some of the Salafis, the fundamentalists, this is upsetting because they view it as like revering the dead or something that you're not supposed to do. I don't know. But some Sufi practice is upsetting to them. So there's at that time, there were 7 million Libyans and 7,000 Salafis. So a very small group of people who decided one night they're going to go and destroy this ancient Sufi mosque. And so this family friend goes out, essentially the freed nice wonder of Libya. and he goes out and he decides that he's going to just talk to these guys and talk to them and sort of try and get them to reflect on, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Do you really want to do this? And just get them to try and be in a reflective state. And so he's talking to them and they're like, yeah, no, I mean, you make a really good point. Like, yes, these things that are in the Quran. Yes. I mean, that's, it's all true, but you don't understand. Like, they do this thing with the dead, and it's very bad, and you really shouldn't do this. And just all the things that are happening at Guantanamo. Like, there's so many bad things happening at Guantanamo.
Guantanamo.
and the guy is like, wait a minute, do you mean Guantanamo? And he goes, la, la, la. No, there was no G in the time of the prophet. Like, that's a foreign corruption. So, but there really are, in the Muslim world, there are read nice wonders who are going out there and trying to engage with these people and trying to de-radicalize them. And obviously, I mean, the Socratic method is universal. It works on humans. Mm-hmm. And so there's no reason why this approach, and that's part of why I want to take street epistemology in this conversation and extract it from sort of the atheist packaging that was used to sell it and just say, this can work with literally anything,
totally,
literally anyone. And it really is. I mean, you know, Socrates was a tutor. Mm-hmm. So it is tutoring. And the only thing that I would add with all of this is the importance of acting. Because what I find so helpful is playing roles and playing characters. And crucially, what you have to be doing is you have to be managing what the emotional dynamic is. So just as you're trying to create wonder, sometimes you have to, when the, you know, person is getting threatened or getting defensive, then you make sure to humiliate and mock yourself. And you're like, what do I know? Like, I'm just a tutor, but like, this doesn't make any sense to me.
Exactly. That's like Jonathan Haidt's, you know, intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. Make sure the person's elephant is leaning the right way.
That's right.
So they can, you know, reason clearly. Yeah.
Well, so you just have a chance, right?
Yeah.
So that the person can be a little bit reflective. And so part of that is that, you know, I think the schema that is laid out here, these five steps, they're good if you're looking to get into this or to even experiment with this. And this is where mixed mental arts really sort of moves into the Fight Club world. So we sort of have talked on the Facebook group about having assignments.
Yeah.
And they, you know, Tyler Durden has this great assignment that you have to go out, pick a fight and lose, which obviously is just a great check on ego. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's real value as well to picking arguments and losing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just getting your ass handed to you, because that is really what's going to teach you humility. But in the same way, I think that it's something that you should practice on your family. Like, you know, how do you have these conversations that for years and years and years you've avoided that haven't gone well, and see if you can find a way to work into it. And just, I think crucially, what's smart about that wonder step is just trying to understand. Like,
yeah.
I just don't get this. Like, I just really want to hear your story. And let's just examine this, because Paul Ekman had that great thing on his podcast where he said that torture doesn't work. And actually the most effective interrogation technique is to really want to hear the other person's story.
Yeah, that's great.
And so I think this is a great core as we start to, because obviously street epistemology is an evolving art form, and we can infuse it with all this stuff from Haidt and Ekman and, you know, reading people's facial expressions and using comedy. And especially improv comedy, because humor is really, laughter is the thing that cracks beliefs.
Yeah, this whole street epistemology thing is kind of like a social experiment to see how well the Socratic method can go. Like, it's but there has to be other ways as well.
Well, I think it does go, right? Mm-hmm. It does work. I mean, we know that it worked, but how do you I mean, I think it's got to be an evolving playbook. And then also partly it's going to have to be a playbook that is going to be repurposed for different contexts. So, for example, this approach in terms of those guys who want to destroy that Sufi mosque, not necessarily the best approach, right? So what you're trying to do is you're trying to create cognitive dissonance.
Yep.
And then you're trying to help people resolve that cognitive dissonance in a new way. Mm-hmm. Rather than just falling back to their old beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Reed Niswonder of Libyan Reed Niswonder, mm-hmm. is, you know, creating cognitive dissonance. And part of what he's doing is he's putting it up against the Quran and the Hadiths and all of that, because that's the knowledge source that they respect. And so what he's putting up for them, he's putting their intuitions of authority and their sort of, you know, their narrow certainty up against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And as he puts those up against each other, then he creates that cognitive dissonance. And then you can create the reflection.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's really going to depend on, crucially, who is your audience. And so if you're dealing with an Islamic audience, you know, maybe you actually want to lean into the Quran. Or if you're dealing with a Christian audience, maybe you want to lean into that. I mean, for myself, I mean, I talked about this on the Facebook group. I had a student who was an anti-vaxxer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, some people don't like that term, which is why I kind of avoided it earlier in the podcast, but I can't leave things alone for very long. but she, you know, she had grown up in an alternative medicine community and hadn't been vaccinated and had grown up believing that Western medicine was full of idiots and that she was going to go in and she was going to reform them. And we just really unpacked. I mean, it's been a long process, years and years and years. And we've both learned a tremendous amount from each other, because she's become a big fan of Haidt's work too. And part of what she revealed, which I thought was fascinating, is that a lot of the intuitions around that are actually about liberty.
Yeah.
They're really medical libertarians. and they just don't want to be told what to do medically. And then what happens is that doctors very often come in and do the worst thing possible and be like, you have to, which is just going to set them off. And for her, it was really about putting up against each other intuitions of liberty and intuitions of care. Because she was going to go work at a hospital. And if she wasn't vaccinated, she would be putting the patients at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that intuition of care won out and was what led her to cross the threshold on that.
Yeah, you got to be careful to frame your arguments over a correct moral foundation, for sure. Yeah.
And an individualized one.
Yes.
Depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real challenge, is that you're unpacking that person's beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about the human mind is that I compare it to a matryoshka or a Russian nesting doll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of never know what you're going to get when you open up, and all sorts of things will come out that you didn't expect. So in terms of that, I think, you know, Magna Bosco is doing his thing. Who else is in the street epistemology community?
It's if you've seen that video of a guy dancing at the at this like music festival, like out on just this grassy hill, there's that one guy dancing. That was probably Peter Boghossian, you know, who coined the term street epistemology. And the second guy, that's the guy who's most important, it was Anthony Magna Bosco. Because that's when you start to, all the other people around you start to see, oh, well, maybe this guy's not crazy. This could be fun. So I'm probably maybe the 10th person to join the dancing party. So there's quite a few of us now trying to have these conversations and upload them to show them as practical examples of having these types of conversations. There's a Facebook group on Facebook for street epistemology, and there's a website. You can see all of our resources around that. Yeah.
So there's a growing community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the interesting thing is that obviously we're sort of doing the same thing with mixed mental arts.
Yeah.
And you sit astride the two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always interesting because there are these groups and they're often doing related and adjacent things. And the question is, what is the best relationship or the most productive relationship? Because we care about moving ideas, which is pretty much the same thing, mm-hmm. right? How do we give the street epistemology all the resources we've found and all of those ideas? And then how do we learn from them in return? And how are we just having maximum idea sex, maximum diffusion of innovations?
I think it starts with the Culture Matters video series. Once we get that done, we can have them as resources for when people are in a stage after an SE conversation where they're open to evidence, because sometimes that happens where, oh, I don't know, like if I saw something, and we could give them a really great resource to give them that idea.
Right. And so that's part of the next phase for what we're working on here is how do we create better and better tools that are good follow-up tools, good resources. And again, the word street is sort of limiting because you could be having these conversations online with random people on Twitter and Facebook or Reddit. You could be having them with your own family. You can be having them literally anywhere. And we just want to empower people with more and more tools to be able to drop those knowledge bombs on them so that it's hopefully funny and can get people to reflect and get them into that state of aporia.
Yes.
A new skincare line from Mixed Mental Arts. So to that end, I'm working on the scripts, and Katie O has been, you know, and now she's going to be really mad at me because this whole Tom Brady Deflategate thing. but she's, you know, I'm working on those scripts. And then if anybody wants to support those videos, you can support us on Patreon, Mixed Mental Arts. And then you can also buy t-shirts at TeePublic. There's some sweet swag. And all of that money will go to funding the Culture Matters videos. And it's worth making clear that that's really round one for us.
Yeah.
We want to create more and more of these tools that are better and better at moving these ideas. Okay, Reed, what else is on that iPad?
Oh, man. I don't know. Maybe we can end with like a quote about the culture and what tree epistemology can do about that.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
So wonder, open-mindedness, the disposition of being comfortable with not knowing, uncertainty, a skeptical and scientific-minded attitude, and the genuine desire to know what's true. These are the attributes of a liberated mind. Let's observe, let's document, let's carefully describe, and let's be open to discomforting conclusions. Inquiry and wonder must replace dogmatism and certainty. The long-term goal is to create conditions that turn the dispositions of inquiring and wondering into the culturally trumpeted virtues.
That's some nice wonder right there. Who wrote that? Who said that?
I think it was Boghossian.
Oh, there you go. Good for that.
Yep.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of Mixed Mental Arts with Reed Nice Wonder as the official ambassador and emissary of Magna Bosco and the street epistemology community. I actually think this is kind of a cool idea. You know, you would have ambassadors at any court. And so at the court of Emperor Callan, maybe we should have official ambassadors for different communities. So the first ambassador of the street epistemology community is Reed Nice Wonder.
Awesome.
It's an incredible honor. Doesn't mean you'll get to meet Brian Callan, by the way. No. I rarely get to see Brian Callan. So, but you might get lucky enough to one day be in the presence of the emperor.
I can't wait for that.
Thanks so much, ladies and gentlemen.